This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay, Nitya.
Okay, I will begin. So I'm really happy to talk to all of you today. And, you know, please feel free to interrupt with questions as I go along here. So as you can see on my original, my opening slide, I have a mnemonic for my name, which I hope people will find useful. And just to give you a little bit of background about myself, I grew up in India, and South India is where my name is from. I then went to, got a scholarship to do the last 2 years of my high school in the UK. So I went there for 11th and 12th grade. And then I went to, straight from there to Mount Holyoke, which is in Western Massachusetts, for my undergraduate work. From there, I went on to do a PhD in astronomy at Harvard. I then did one postdoc. I was a Pappalardo Fellow at MIT. And then a second postdoc, I was a YCA Prize Fellow at Yale. And then finally, at the end of all that, I got my faculty job at the University of Virginia, and this is my second year here. And as you can see, I work on dynamics in the local group, and I'm really keen on really pushing this method to really answer some fundamental questions in physics and about how the universe proceeds in its structure buildup. And I'm really excited. I really think that this is a key observable that's going to help untangle a lot of mysteries that we have in our standard picture. So if you go to my second slide, as I've just said, I really think it's a heyday for what we call near-field cosmology, which is using precision observations in the local group of galaxies, so the Milky Way, Andromeda, and its environment, to really test the nature of dark matter and to test in detail whether we really understand the important physics involved when galaxies collide and build up their mass. And what you're looking at here is the entire Sloan DR8, so that's Data Release 8 now of the Sloan catalog. And what we've done is we've just taken a filter, which is made up of an old single stellar population, and sort of filtered it through the entire Sloan catalog at a bunch of different distances. And when you do that, you'll see that all this structure pops up, which hopefully is visible. You can see this huge beast that we call the Sagittarius stream. This is all tidal debris in our local neighborhood. You can see Palomar 5, which is a globular cluster and its stream. You can see this thing called the Orphan stream. And then in this particular paper, a new stream that we discovered, which we named Triangulum. It has a couple of different names now. But what this is meant to emphasize is that we have the standard picture of how galaxies grow and evolve. Interestingly, that happens in a bottom-up process, so as opposed to, you know, galaxies being sort of made from some monolithic reservoir of gas, we think that they actually build up their mass instead by smaller systems merging and being cannibalized by larger systems. So smaller systems merge to form bigger systems. And in that process, these smaller systems get tidally disrupted by the bigger system, and what you're looking at in this figure is at least prima facie evidence for the fact that this cannibalization process is going on in the form of these debris streams and the halo, and the fact that the Milky Way definitely seems to have built up at least some of its mass by cannibalizing smaller systems. Now, of course, yes, go ahead.
This is Harley. I got a question. And presumably, then, by dating the stars in the stream, although presumably it's an admixture of stars of all kinds of dates, but presumably folks can date when the tidal interaction occurred to produce the streams.
Well, that's that is really the hope here. So I think that's what we're trying to move towards, you know, exactly those kind of precision measurements that would allow us to do just that. But, you know, you've set me up very nicely here, you know, to go from a big picture such as this to, you know, actually understanding the kind of question and answering the kind of question that you just asked me, there are a lot of different ingredients. And so if you go to my next slide, so slide 3, you know, having at least this kind of data in the local group has led to a bunch of questions that lead to a tension with that sort of basic picture that I just laid out for you, okay? And so one thing is that we have structure forming from the bottom up, but the other thing is that that is a symptom, if you will, of the properties of cold dark matter, okay? So the question is, can we actually go from those kind of measurements that I just showed you to understanding the properties of cold dark matter? Now, cold dark matter is so called because it is dynamically cold, and so that's where the coldness comes from. In fact, that's why it's called cold, is what I should say. And so when you have a dark matter particle with slow-moving properties such as that, then you can very simply run a computer simulation to sort of help guide you as to how structure would form if that's really the seed for how structure forms, if such a particle is really the seed for how structure forms. And now we have a whole bunch of, you know, very high-tech simulations that simulate just that, and then they make a bunch of predictions at the end of it, okay? And then we can see whether in the local group, at least, where we can make precision measurements, those predictions are, in fact, correct. And from folks trying to actually confront the theory with the observations, we've come up with a bunch of tensions in the local group, okay? One is the missing satellites problem. This is a well-known problem at this point, which is that cold dark matter-based structure formation simulations predict much more, many more satellite galaxies around something the size of the Milky Way than we can actually observe today, than we do actually observe. And depending on whose simulation you believe, you know, this can be between 500 to 1,000 sort of satellite galaxy type structures floating around, whereas we thus far have really only managed to find 40 or so, okay? So there's a lot of debris missing in the local group. And then there's a bunch of ways that you can solve that issue. One way to solve it is to say that, well, all these satellite galaxies that are supposed to be out there that we can't see may be completely dark matter dominated. So they have very little star formation, very little stars, and so they're basically just dark blobs floating around in the halo, so how could we hope to see them? And in fact, you know, that's definitely one aspect, I think, to the solution. However, there's now a second issue, which is that not only are we missing the small satellite galaxies, which may be completely dark, and by the way, the reason that they're completely dark is because these very shallow potential wells will have had a hard time keeping baryons in the epoch of something like reionization, where there was a UV background that would actually sort of dim these galaxies. However, slightly larger satellite galaxies with deeper potential wells should manage to hold on to their baryons even during the epoch of reionization, and so they should not be dark, and yet now it seems that we're also missing massive satellite galaxies in the local group. So that's the second issue there. It's also cast in a density argument, but basically there's overwhelming evidence now from a bunch of different lines that not only are we missing satellites, but also the satellites that we do see are much of much lower density than what's measured in these simulations that have cold dark matter as their basis. And then a third issue is that, again, these simulations, cold dark matter-based structure formation predicts that the shape of the dark matter halo that surrounds galaxies such as the Milky Way and Andromeda should be triaxial, okay, but most of the observational evidence, which I should say is quite thin at this point. I mean, there's not a lot of, it's hard to make these kind of observations, but the observations point towards the fact that, in fact, the dark matter halo might be more spherical than is expected. And then finally, the picture that I'm showing here is from Pawlowski et al., 2013, and what it's showing is that the satellite galaxies that we do observe around the local group seem to lie along this very thin plane, okay? And the jury is actually a little bit out as to whether you would expect these thin planes of satellites, even in cold dark matter-based structure formation. This particular thing has been used to argue against the vanilla properties of the dark matter particle. But all I would say here is that a major component, so if there's one build in this slide, and what that says is that a major missing component in trying to actually confront period observations is the orbits of all of these things. So, Holly, just going back to your question, we can try to chemically date the stars in those debris streams that I showed you in the previous slide. That's definitely a promising way forward, but another crucial missing piece of information is the actual orbits of these things. And if we had orbits for all satellites and, you know, globular clusters in the local group, that could really hugely reduce the phase space of information that we actually need to, you know, look through in order to actually confront the theory. So I'll just move on to the next slide. So just very quickly, I wanted to say that, you know, proper motions are the two are what give you to the two components of the tangential velocity of an object. The third component is made up of the radial velocity or the line of sight velocity. That's actually quite relatively easy to measure using the Doppler shift, okay, so whether something is coming towards you or going away from you. However, the tangential velocity, what we call the proper motion, the motion in the plane of the sky, is much more difficult to measure because especially at the kind of distances that I'm talking about, you know, the halo of the Milky Way and further on into the local group, this tangential motion is really, really tiny, okay, and as you get further in distance, it becomes tinier still. And then there's also an issue of what would you measure this tangential motion against. So you also need, you know, a suitable background reference frame against which to measure this motion. So interestingly, the Hubble Space Telescope, even though it was not launched to do astrometry, to measure these kind of motions, it has really been successful at doing this. So I think that's an interesting statement in and of itself, you know, which just makes you think about what future observatories might actually do, even if they have been built for completely different reasons. You know, you never know what you might actually get out of a well-built instrument. But, you know, Hubble Space Telescope has actually ended up becoming, in my opinion, an astrometry machine, and it has done, I've just listed here a bunch of interesting measurements that it's been able to make that you are welcome to go and check out if you're interested. So I'll just move on to my next slide. So why are proper motions so difficult to measure? And if you don't remember anything else from my talk, here is a really useful equation. It just helps you calculate go from milliarcseconds per year, which is what's actually measured in the plane of the sky, to a kilometer per second error. Okay. So one issue is that it's you have to multiply by the distance there, and so that will already tell you that, you know, this is going to get worse as you try to do it further out in the local group. But what this slide is illustrating is that if you wanted to measure the tangential velocity or proper motion of something like the Fornax dwarf galaxy, which is at about 140 kiloparsecs, then an error of a milliarcsecond per year leads to a velocity error of around 700 kilometers per second, okay? And a milliarcsecond per year is sort of how well you can do, you know, on a good instrument from the ground. So that's, you know, that's a very typical error. And so this is why, you know, people have mostly ignored proper motions and why you really need to get to sub-milliarcsecond per year if you want to, you know, actually provide a observation that would constrain anything. So if you go on to the next slide, I'll just start going through now a few interesting observations that we've been able to make and what they say about the Milky Way halo. The first thing that we wanted to do was look at, you know, the most prominent dwarf galaxy system in the Milky Way, made up of the large and small Magellanic clouds. And what the reason that we were especially interested in trying to measure the proper motions for this system is because they have this extremely prominent and huge tail of gas. Okay, so this picture is actually just showing you neutral hydrogen. It's an H1 picture of the Magellanic system. And you can see the LMC and the SMC, the two galaxies involved. But you can also see this really huge whopping tail of neutral hydrogen gas. And there were, before people had proper motions for these two galaxies, if you just do my build there, what that's showing you is a previous effort to actually understand the system and understand how this tail formed, okay? And that was just a simple picture of tidal disruption, as we've already been talking about, that the LMC and the SMC, in this case, have been orbiting in the Milky Way for the past Hubble time. So that's a plot of distance versus time, where zero here is today. And so in the past, they've been making a bunch of orbits around the Milky Way, and this tidal, this H1, the neutral hydrogen, was pulled out of the system because of this interaction. Okay, but at the time, there was no leading tail, so you can see also some leading material in that picture there. Of course, it looks different than the trailing tail, and it looks more diffuse. But however, at the time, there was no leading component to this feature, and again, a tidal interaction will create both a leading and a trailing tail. But in this case, because the leading tail looks a little weird, there was also a competing theory, so if you go to my build, what that's showing you is a competing theory for how this Magellanic stream formed, which was that as these galaxies orbited the Milky Way, the gas was actually being ram pressure stripped by the hot halo in the Milky Way. And so there were these two competing theories. We decided to try to measure the tangential velocity and see if we could actually, you know, put some constraints on this theory. And so if you go to my next slide, what we decided to do was that we had a really nice reference frame. As I said, that sort of key in proper motion work is to actually have a suitable reference frame that doesn't move with respect to what you're trying to measure. And in this case, we had a sample of quasars, very interesting astrophysical objects in and of themselves, but in this case, just far enough away, you know, at high enough redshift that they didn't move with respect to the foreground Milky Way, the foreground LMC and SMC stars. So the colored symbols in this plot are showing you the location of the quasars with respect to the LMC and the SMC. And so what you can see here is that there's a bunch of fields, right? So the actual galaxies themselves are sort of well sampled by this by this set of quasars. But what we wanted to do was, you know, point Hubble at each of these quasar fields, have the quasar somewhere in the center, and then measure how the quasar moves with respect to the background, sorry, the foreground LMC or SMC stars. Okay, so if you go to the next slide, I'm just showing you our first attempt at making that, the result of our first attempt at actually making that measurement. Okay, so I actually was able to, at the time, convince a Hubble Space Telescope TAC that we could do this measurement at because of Hubble's precision and stability, that we could do this measurement in a baseline of 2 years. Okay. Now, if you know much about proper motion work, usually people are using a 100-year sort of baseline just to get that error, you know, the milliarcsecond per year, that number down. Okay. But again, we were able to do this measurement in 2 years, and the result was somewhat surprising, though. So on the left-hand side of the plot, I'm showing you again the orbits expected, you know, once we had actually the full 3D velocity now known for the LMC. And you can see that the new velocity, so that's the Kalevala et al. 2006, the blue line, okay, so again, zero is today, and we're going backwards in time. Okay, now in order to actually look at how this orbit is, you have to assume some sort of potential for the Milky Way. And on the left-hand side, again, we've assumed just what previous authors had assumed. So again, in that tidal stripping and ram pressure scenario that I showed you in the previous slide, this is just an isothermal sphere for the Milky Way. All that means is that the density goes like r to the minus 2, okay, and that's just the same. It's a constant everywhere. This isothermal sphere for the Milky Way also has no cutoff, okay, and so technically this is sort of an infinite mass sphere. Okay? Now you might say that's not physical. That is correct, but, you know, it's what other authors have tried, and it's a galaxy potential that has been used a lot to describe the Milky Way. So, again, on the left-hand side, with the new velocities, okay, compared to the old velocity, so the new are shown in blue and the old are shown in red. You might ask me, what are the old velocities? Well, that was just using that tidal stripping model, okay, finding something that matched the location of the Magellanic Stream and then just saying what the velocity was of that particular orbit. Okay, so that's not a measurement. That's something that comes from theory. And you can see that even in this unphysical Milky Way potential, the new velocities lead to a past orbital history for the LMC that's quite different than what we thought before. It has a period roughly twice that what we thought before and an apogalacticon of more than twice what we thought before. Okay. But, again, we don't think that the Milky Way halo is well approximated by this simple picture. In fact, you know, simulations make a prediction if lambda CDM, so the cold dark matter picture, is correct. The simulations predict that, in fact, the Milky Way halo should be an NFW profile. Okay, now that's a lot of acronyms, but, again, what that means is that at the relevant distances here, rho, so the density, is going like r to the minus 3 instead of r to the minus 2, okay? And just with that simple change, the picture for what the LMC was doing in the past is radically different. Okay, the blue line was our average velocity measurement, and you can see that it makes no past passages. You have to change our measurement by 4 sigma, so if you come down to the red line, to even get one past passage for the LMC around the Milky Way. Sorry, was there a question?
No. Okay. Well, there may be. Any questions for Nitya? Okay, yeah, please continue.
So, again, you have to change our velocity by more than 4 sigma to even get one previous passage. But that particular orbit goes far beyond what we call the virial radius of the Milky Way. So again, just the physical extent as predicted from this cold dark matter-based simulation of the Milky Way. Okay, and the period of that orbit is roughly a Hubble time. Okay, interestingly, even the old velocities, okay, that red line from the plot on the left, fare quite differently in this NFW model for the Milky Way. So much as I would like to say that, you know, this is all because of our measurement, in fact, what this is telling you is that the galaxy model that you assume for the galaxy makes a big difference in how we might interpret, you know, the past histories of all of the satellites, you know, in the local group. So this was, however, quite shocking. I wouldn't say it was shocking for folks who do, you know, cosmology, but it was definitely shocking for folks that study the LMC and the SMC. And so we were actually able to convince the HST TAC to give us a third epoch to confirm this proper motion measurement. So if you go to my next slide, we're showing you what's new with that. So again, you can just skip over that LMC rotation slide and go to the slide after that, in which hopefully you have the bills. If you have, you know, the PDF version, then my story is somewhat ruined. But if you have the bills, what you're seeing is how we actually do the measurement. Okay, so this is a 1x1 pixel master frame for one of our quasar fields. Okay, around the LMC. And the first set of points labeled ACS1 is the location of the quasar with respect to the foreground LMC star field. Okay, and then that repeated over 8 dithers. Okay, so the spread in those points is actually giving you a real estimate of how well we can center the quasar with respect to the stars. Okay, we then waited 2 years and then did the same thing. So that's represented by ACS2. Again, this was done with the Advanced Camera for Surveys on the Hubble Space Telescope. So we waited 2 years and repeated the measurement. That's the second cloud of points. And as you can see, that's already a high signal-to-noise motion. And what that motion actually is -1 times the proper motion of the LMC. Okay, because again, in this particular way of setting up the problem, we're making the quasar move and the star field remain fixed, even though in reality it's the opposite that's happening. Okay, but again, there's always a straight line between two sets of points like that. So if we were to redo this measurement, you know, will the third set of points actually lie along this line, or will there be some curvature to the line which would indicate some kind of systematic error that we haven't taken into account? Okay, so if you go to my build, you'll see our third set of points. Okay, now ACS, the camera that we used on ACS, which was the high resolution channel, actually died in the meanwhile. So we ended up using a new camera, the Wide Field Camera 3, which in hindsight was a blessing in disguise because, you know, it's a completely different camera, it has different systematics, you know, it's a completely independent measurement, if you will. So now there's a baseline of 7 years, okay, between these points. And you can see that, you know, this is a really high signal-to-noise motion, and it also does confirm our original measurement, okay? So at this point, HST, you know, we're getting such good astrometry with HST at these kind of time baselines, you know, 5 to 7 year time baselines, that we can actually go beyond bulk motion. Okay, so if you go to my next slide, what you're seeing is, so in the previous slide, you know, that particular measurement, we had that same measurement for 22 different quasar fields around the LMC, right? So we can actually remove the proper motion, remove the center of mass motion from those measurements and actually look at the residual. Okay, so now we're going beyond just bulk motion. We're trying to see if we can figure out internal motions in this galaxy. Okay, so this slide, what it's showing you is the long black bar, that has actually, that was the center of mass proper motion, the tangential velocity of the LMC, that's been subtracted. Okay, and hopefully what you can see is a residual, which is a clockwise rotation, okay, on that slide. Now, the points, the residual motion actually starts at the points, and then the squares there are giving you a sense of our errors, okay? And the red points, the red lines, are quasar fields for which we had the three epochs of data, so like I showed you in the previous slide, and the green points are quasar fields for which we have only two epochs of data. Okay, and the LMC center is sort of in the middle of that slide. So this is really the first time that proper motion rotation has been measured for a galaxy in the optical. Okay, this has been done using VLBI, so long baseline array techniques in the radio, but this is really the first time that we're getting to this kind of accuracy in the optical part of the spectrum. If you go to the next slide, it's just taking that residual signal and showing you what that means. Okay, so again, we've been able to measure rotation in the LMC. So, you know, the LMC is just a smaller version of the Milky Way. And, you know, it's a disk galaxy. It has ordered rotation, et cetera. So it's interesting to actually measure this for, you know, another galaxy other than the Milky Way. And so we've been able to actually measure its rotation curve. What's useful about being able to do this in proper motion space as opposed to line of sight velocity space is that you don't have inclination issues, so you can actually figure out everything, all the geometric properties of the system directly, okay? But again, what you're seeing here is velocity as a function, the rotation velocity as a function of position in the disk of the LMC. You can see both in angular and real coordinates there. So the LMC, you know, has about a 90 kilometer per second rotation velocity. And I put this up here to actually just show you that we are getting beyond bulk rotation, bulk motions, and actually starting to be able to probe the internal structures of dwarf galaxies. Okay, and that's interesting because, again, one of the things that I said was a point of tension between the theory and observations is that we want to know what the density of these dwarf galaxies is because, again, Lambda CDM makes a very firm prediction for that, but we haven't really been able to measure it thus far because, again, all the disentanglement takes place in line-of-sight velocity space in which you're just missing, you know, you're just missing two components of the velocity, right? So if we can add that, if we can actually have full 3D velocities, you know, for the internal parts of dwarf galaxies, we can really start to, you know, really test whether we have issues with the theory or whether we're just missing information. But again, this, you know, this is interesting also from just trying to understand the LMC and what that, you know, trailing gas feature may be, et cetera, but I'm just going to skip right ahead of that. So just very quickly, we had a press release on this. This the next slide is showing you that same set of, you know, rotation points, but this time superimposed on an actual real data picture of the LMC. They've added, you can see, first of all, you know, how huge the LMC is, you know, in the night sky. They've added the full moon for reference, and they've also put in a horizon just to give you, you know, a sense of what it looks like. If you go to the next slide and then click one more time, they actually made an animation of the rotation of the LMC, which hopefully you can see. That's based on our measurements. It rotates once every 250 million years. And as it's said in that release, the precision that we were able to achieve to make this measurement was equivalent to being able to measure the speed of human hair growth at moon distance. on average is about 6 inches per year. So again, you know, Hubble is really, its stability and the fact that, you know, it's at this point been in space for quite a while, is interesting, because, you know, the baselines now are getting quite long and, you know, it really can be sort of routinely used as an astrometry machine. So if you go to the next slide, I'm now sort of moving, you know, lest this sound like a hodgepodge of things, I'm actually moving down the mass scale here. I started with the largest dwarf galaxy, and now I'm going to, you know, a less massive dwarf galaxy, the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy, and trying to figure out what's going on with that, okay? Are there any questions at this point?
No, not in this sense.
Okay. So the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy, you know, is again one of the dwarf galaxies in the Milky Way, within the Milky Way halo, and this time it actually does have a stream that's made up of stars. It's not only seen in neutral hydrogen. What you're seeing on the upper right is a model of the disruption of this dwarf galaxy by the Milky Way and the location of that tidal debris, okay, which actually does match the location of the tidal debris as measured using a technique like I showed you on my first slide. Okay, so you can see where the core of the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy is, and you can see, you know, these spectacular tidal tails that have now been traced out a full 360 degrees around the Milky Way using all-sky surveys like TUMAS and Sloan, okay? Now, many folks have tried to model this system. What exists in terms of data are the locations of the stars on the sky and radial velocities for some of these stars, okay? There's also a bunch of chemical information now for this system, which again is going to help greatly. But even just trying to match the location of the tails and the radial velocity as measured along some of the parts of the tail has been a huge effort, okay? And nobody has actually been able to come up with a successful model for the Milky Way halo that explains this distribution of stars until now. Okay, and that was done by Law and Majewski in 2010. But what they had to come up with for the Milky Way halo is a little bit unexpected. Okay, specifically, it is oblate, which is fine. So it's a triaxial halo that, as I said, was expected from, again, this cold dark matter-based structure formation. Okay, but its axis, its symmetry axis is actually flipped by 90 degrees than what you would expect, okay? So the short axis of this triaxial halo is actually in the disk plane. And this is not expected to be a long-term sort of configuration for a dark matter halo. You would expect that the symmetry axis lies along the disk, and these types of configurations are not expected to be long-lived. Okay, so, but again, this is what they had to do in order to match the data. Let's just say that it is a model that matches the data. There's a question of uniqueness, but, you know, again, this is a tough game to play. And this is the first time that someone actually came up with a model that matched the data. So if you go to the next slide, of course, you want to measure proper motions. again, that provides missing information here, crucial missing information. And what we did is we've been playing this game for a while now. As I said, the HSD archive at this point is quite formidable. And so a very efficient way to use it is to actually look for whether the archive already contains a suitably deep and well-dithered epoch, you know, along this stream that you could use. and then only take a second epoch of data. And that's, you know, a really efficient way to go after these kind of debris streams in the halo. And so we looked whether the archive actually consisted of a suitably old, suitably deep, and well-dithered epoch. And in fact, we found four fields along the Sagittarius tidal stream, as is traced out by the picture, the figure that's on the top of the slide. Okay, so we have four fields along the tidal stream with sort of 6 to 9 year time baselines. And so we tried to measure the proper motion. If you go to the next slide, this is all hard work that's done by Tony Sohn at Johns Hopkins, and the paper is now out, so if you want to go and look at it in detail, feel free to do that. What this slide is showing you is our measurement, which is on the bottom left. Okay, that's one of the fields, that's the field marked F1 along the stream. And what you're looking at is proper motion in the north, and proper motion in the west, just in the plane of the sky as measured for everything in that field, okay? And so what we saw for the stars in that field was actually sort of a distribution in proper motion space that appeared to be clumped, okay? And then there's a bunch of stars at zero. There's a bunch of stuff at zero, which we think are actually faint, unresolved background galaxies, okay? And then there's stuff that's highlighted in blue and stuff that's highlighted in orange, okay? When we just look at the proper motion distribution, that's what we see. And then if we try to fit an isochrone that matches what you would expect from the age and metallicity of something like the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy, we find that these stars actually lie along those isochrones, so they're consistent also in chemistry space with being debris from the Sagittarius dwarf. Okay, and then when we just put them, so now in the figure on the right, what you've done is just put the average of those two clumps on a prediction from the Law and Majewski model for what the proper motions should be along the stream. Okay, and as you can see, they actually match this model remarkably well. Now, this is not a fit of any kind. We just put our measurement on top of their model. Okay, so if you look at the points marked F1, you can see that the blue stuff, the trailing arm stars, fall along the trailing stream. But as I say, in proper motion space, we also detected this third sort of clump of stars. And what the kinematics of those stars match seems to be actually a previous wrap as predicted from the model. Okay, so not only are we're getting to the kind of precision where we can actually not just measure, you know, the main sort of arm, debris arm of the stream, we're actually being able to disentangle, perhaps, even previous wraps. Okay, and you can see that I've also shown you the measurements for the other four fields. Remarkably, they actually fit this weird galaxy model quite well. Okay, does that mean that's the correct model for the galaxy? No. Okay, again, there's this question of uniqueness, and I think to really get from these kind of measurements to an overall picture of what the galaxy halo looks like, we need to do this for multiple streams. Okay, but again, at least, you know, in a poor man's theory sort of way, we haven't actually just been able to rule out this Law and Majewski model. So that's interesting. Okay, I'll just skip the next slide in the just to save some time. And now I'm moving to my next slide, which is moving even further down this luminosity function, down to a very small debris thing called Palomar 5. It's a globular cluster, again, orbiting in the halo of the Milky Way that shows prominent tidal tails. Okay, so if you just go through my builds there, what you're looking at is, again, a theoretical fit to the location of tidal debris from PAL-5. Okay, so The actual globular cluster is at DEC of 0 and RA of about 228 or so. Hopefully you can see that. And again, the contours in blue are showing you the location of the tidal stream that's emanating from the system. Okay, again, we didn't have proper motions, at least CCD-based proper motions for this globular cluster, but in a theoretical work in which they actually just marginalized over the proper motions and tried to fit both the location of the debris and, again, some radial velocities that were measured along the debris, these authors, Cooper et al. And Pearson et al., tried to see whether PAL-5 actually fits in with this weird galaxy model from Law and Majewski. Okay? So they tested two galaxy models. They tested the Law and Majewski model, which is shown on the bottom. Okay? And then they also just tested a simple spherical model for the halo of the Milky Way. And what they found is, marginalizing over proper motion here, they found that the Law and Majewski model, the one on the bottom, actually doesn't fit the data very well if you look at the close-up of where the actual globular cluster is and the red points, which are the fit from them running their models. You can see that that S shape that's sort of characteristic of tidal disruption is not well fit. Okay. But in a simple spherical model for the Milky Way, the top plot there, that S shape is very well fit. Okay, so again, this is weird, right? I mean, at least in this theoretical work, PAL-5 seems to follow kinematics as expected in a simple spherical model for the Milky Way, but the Sagittarius seems to follow kinematics in a more complicated triaxial potential. So again, as I say, we're getting there, right? I mean, I think it's really exciting that we're able to not just test gross galaxy properties, but actually test them as a function of object and location in the halo. So if you go to the next slide, of course, we want to measure proper motions for this system. And this is now using a completely different technique, okay? This is using ground-based data now. Okay, these tidal streams, I'm interested in a lot of different approaches to this problem. And tidal streams have, extend a huge amount on the sky. And so using something like HST to follow them up, while you get very high precision velocities for few stars, as I showed you in our Sagittarius work, maybe it's also worth going after all sky techniques, but getting lower per star precision. Okay, so what I've been doing is I have a campaign going in which I've been using Sloan as a first epoch, and I've been taking a second epoch of data with large field of view ground-based images. Okay, in this case, I'm using the large binocular telescope, which we have access to at UVA. It's total overkill for the system, by the way. But they gave me time, and so the errors are really dominated by Sloan errors, okay? And what you're looking at on this slide is, again, our coverage using LBT of the PAL-5 cluster and the tails, okay? The red squares or whatever polygons show you our coverage. And the picture on the right is, again, a matched filter technique to the location of the stream and the globular cluster. And the blue points are all the stars that match a match filter, and the red points are galaxies that we're using as a background reference.
Nitya, this is Harley. I got to play the role of time manager.
Yes.
We own this line 24/7, and we've got this room for another hour or so, but it is about 5 minutes before the hour.
Yes. So I will just show the results from this and just sort of wrap up with some thoughts for the future. Does that sound good?
Sounds great.
Okay. So if you go to the next slide, which you can skip, that's just showing the match filter that we're using. And then on the next slide, you'll see our actual measurement for the proper motion of the cluster Okay. The blue point, this is work done by my postdoc, Tobias Fritz. The blue lines and point are our measurement. It's the first CCD-based measurement for the PAL-5 proper motion. And the other points there are based on photographic plate work. Okay. interestingly, none of these really match up with each other, but interestingly, the black star is a prediction from the theoretical work for a spherical halo for the Milky Way. Okay, so our measurement for the proper motion is consistent with what they predict in a spherical halo and not consistent with what they would predict in a triaxial halo. What does this mean? You know, maybe this is actually evidence for some sort of radial change, you know, radial gradient in the shape of the halo as we go from, you know, PAL-5 to Sagittarius. You know, I don't know, but I think it's interesting. So just to wrap up there, if you just skip everything and go to slide 29. So I just want to wrap up with some thoughts for the future, okay, since that's what your whole series is about. so here's what I think is really, you know, future, the future in this field, okay, and that is a multi-conjugate adaptive optics. Okay, so what we've been doing is we've started a program. We've just been granted a long, large program on Gemini South using about 148 hours with the adaptive optics system, okay, on Gemini South. It's called GSAOI. And it's a new capability, fairly new capability on this telescope, in which you can actually take out, you know, the atmosphere in real time over a fairly large field of view, okay? Previously, all the adaptive optic systems have been really small field of view instruments where you can only correct sort of a 10 arc second by 10 arc second field of view. This is actually more like a 90 by 90 arc second field of view, and that's about a quarter of, say, something like ACS, and so we're really getting to the point where we can do this kind of work using adaptive optics from the ground. And, you know, what could be cooler, right? But in this picture, I'm actually showing you a photograph. That's a photograph taken by my postdoc of the laser in action, okay, and data for a particular galaxy, that we're, sorry, globular cluster that we're going after called Pyxis. And, I mean, this is awesome, right? This is, you know, huge telescopes, giant lasers, and deformable mirrors, you know, that can be deformed, you know, up to 800 times a second. So it's really a neat system. If you go to the next slide, I'm just showing you the targets that we are targeting as part of this program. The first cut, actually, we actually looked for everything that would be doable with the system, and the main limitation actually comes from needing a suitable reference frame of tipped-tilt stars, tipped-tilt stars to actually take out some of the corrections needed. Because of the CCDs that they're using in this case, those stars actually have to be fairly bright, and so that's basically the restriction. So we're going after everything that actually has adequate numbers of tipped-tilt stars. If you go to the next slide, you'll see that, you know, we're getting really high image quality from the system. This is the full width half max over the entire field of view for one of our targets. You can see that it's an average of about 80 milliarc seconds, which is equivalent to HST type image quality. So it's really exciting, you know, that this system is working so well. And the next slide is actually just, this is probably a little bit too much detail, but showing you our expected errors. But again, our expected errors at the end of the program will be dominated by how well we can center the background galaxies, which we're using as our reference. But again, the data that we have in hand is indicating that we can do really well, again, HST level quality. And then on slide 33, the next slide, I'm actually showing you that visually, okay, this is one of our fields, a Pyxis globular cluster that in the top left hand you can see the image from using the AO system, okay, in K-band, and in the bottom you can see the image in ACS. Okay, so you can again see that, you know, the image quality is similar. And what's really exciting about this particular target is that by design, it already has one epoch of imaging in the HST archive, giving us, you know, a fairly long baseline there, 2009 to 2015. And so we can actually measure the proper motion of the system right away. And this is something that I see as a really unique thing to be able to do in the future, because if we can calibrate adaptive optics techniques in the infrared to, you know, HST optical, then just with one epoch of imaging, you know, using a system like GEMS, GSAOI, we can go after many, many things in the HST archive, and it's a really powerful way of leveraging, you know, that unique archive and keeping it, you know, useful and alive in the future. And again, this particular technique can be extended, you know, infinitely in some sense with all the, you know, next generation extremely large telescopes, which all have, you know, adaptive optics capabilities planned. So I'll just conclude with those thoughts. You know, there's, I think, beyond, you know, getting beyond even, you know, surveys such as Gaia, which will do the inner halo very well, if we want to push out to the local group, you know, push further out into the local group, I think adaptive optics with, and, you know, even in future telescopes is really the way to go. So I'll just stop there and take questions. Thank you for your attention.
Excellent. Thank you. Do folks have questions? The intern, I got an email from the interns. They had to run off to another thing this morning. Do folks who are online have any questions? Jeremy.
Hi, this is Jeremy Schnittman at Goddard. Well, I was going to ask about Gaia. Could you give a few more words about, you know, the relative merits of using Gaia for astrometry and other HST ground-based stuff?
Yes, certainly. If you go to slide 28, so Gaia, you know, is going to be hugely transformative. You know, it is bright limited. So, in the question of, so, you know, it's really going to clean up in the inner part of the galaxy. Okay. So that's going to be fantastic. But the question is, you know, if we want to answer the particular questions that I've, you know, posed in this talk, which are, can we get to the level at which we can measure density profiles, for example, for dwarf galaxies, then, you know, you're getting to the point where Gaia will be limited by what it can do, and will be limited by the existence of bright enough giants in these dwarf galaxies in order to be able to do that. So what this plot is showing you is for a sample of, you know, interesting dwarf galaxies in the local group, the trade-off basically between Gaia and HST or HST plus something else is at about 80 kiloparsecs. Okay, so these are actually based on real star counts, actually looking at the stellar populations of these dwarf galaxies and then using the formula that, the updated formula that Gaia has on its website to estimate the errors. And so you can see that Gaia sort of dominates, you know, over HST, you know, out to about 80 kiloparsecs. It gives you smaller errors. But then if you go beyond that, then, you know, HST or HST plus something else is really winning.
So how do you use JWST with HST? Is that just a time baseline? Or?
Yeah, this is just with a time baseline of 5 years. Sorry, so the blue HST, I should have explained, this is assuming a time baseline of 5 years for Gaia. So not their first data release, but, like, you know, their next data release. And also a 5-year HST time baseline, which, as I said, we've been able to get And then for HST plus JWST, I think we use an 8-year time baseline. But the errors for JWST at this point are, you know, in this particular calculation, not horribly sophisticated. We're just assuming that it'll achieve similar image quality as HST.
Any other? How about one more quick question?
So if you're limited, it sounds like by your PSF size, is that right?
Yes.
So if you know if you're talking about HST times a factor of 5, so your PSF drops at the same wavelength, but or a factor of 4. Sorry, by a factor of 4. That seems like it would, you know, improve your at least your uncertainty significantly. But mm-hmm. are you more worried about time baseline? Like, do you get equivalent improvements just by a long time baseline, or does your actual PSF size matter at that point if you can have a long time baseline?
Right. So the thing about time baseline is that if you get to divide both your random and your systematic errors by that time baseline. So the time baseline really is crucial in that it helps you to get a handle on your systematics, whereas the PSF size really just goes into your random errors. But in this case, you know, it's really understanding the systematics that's key.
Yeah. But it sounds like for the rotation studies, where you're actually looking at the rotation of something like the LMC mm-hmm. or something else, that's where your PSF size probably makes a huge difference, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Thanks.
Well, thank you all. Thank you, Nitya. This is a good experiment. It's an excellent presentation. One quick comment. The following is not at all a trivial comment. These were some of the best images, most instructive images, charts and figures that I've seen in a long time. This is very clear and useful, so thank you for the time that you put into it.
Thank you.
And the recording is now going to end, so thank you.
Thank you so much.
In any case, so yeah, Nitya, I hope you will be dialing into some of our future talks.
Like yes, I thank you. I do see those emails, so I will certainly dial in.
Yes, and feel free to share them.
Okay.
Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.